You know what makes Travis so furious? Having to move a raspberry to get to a strawberry.
Or godforsaken blueberry.
I also love the fact that, like, I hate paying for these because they just grow. Like, we get
the blackberry
20 pounds of them in our neighborhood over the summer, and though, I hate buying them.
They're delicious, though.
They're so good.
Yeah.
Especially, like, when it's warm outside, you go pick, and they're hot, and then you go home and you make some, like, crumble or crisp or cobbler.
I guess, whatever.
Depends on where the crust is.
Yeah, pick one of them. They're so all delicious.
Good. Yeah.
Welcome to County Connection, the official podcast of the Washington State Association of Counties, where we dive into the legislative issues shaping the future of our communities. From budgets to public safety, infrastructure to elections, we'll break down what's happening in Olympia and how it impacts counties from across the Evergreen State. Stay informed, stay engaged, and join us as we amplify the voice of Washington's 39 counties.
Welcome back, everybody, to the County Connection podcast. I'm Paul Jewell, your host and government relations director for the Washington State Association of Counties here in Olympia. It's day 102 of a 105-day legislative session, but of course, at WASAC, we don't count the days. We make the days count. Speaking of making the days count, Travis, how are you?
I thought there were 2 days left. The fact that there's 3 days left is slightly terrifying.
Yeah,
so I lost a day in there somewhere, but otherwise I'm doing very, very well.
It's always disturbing to find out when you've lost a day, that's for sure.
Right? Today's Thursday, though. At least I know that.
Today's Thursday,
okay, I just didn't count. I didn't use my fingers.
It's Thursday at about 11:30, actually, okay, just to put a timestamp on it for everybody.
All right. Okay, perfect.
And we're almost at the end, Travis, so hang on. Stay with us.
Three more days
to go. How are things?
Things are good. You can definitely feel some winding down.
How many sessions is this for you now as a staff member at WASAC?
This will be my third session as a WASAC staff member.
Okay. All right. So this is your second long session then, because you did a long session, a short session, and now another long session.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And how is this one compared to the previous?
I don't know that I can make a really good comparison, because that first one, everything was unfamiliar and new,
yeah, right?
From the perspective of nothing was familiar. And I think that this one, having heard a lot of veterans that have experienced many long sessions talk about this one also feeling significantly different than previous sessions, it just sort of felt like a short session that was stretched out as far as like intensity, number of bills, just the amount of work that went into getting this stuff done had the same urgency, but just lasted twice as the same urgency as a short session, but lasted longer. So
yeah, you know, the long sessions tend to kind of ramp up more slowly, right? And there's more time to evaluate bills, and there's more time to do the analysis and talk to people and whatnot. But this one really started like, and I think we talked about this at the beginning when we were doing some of these podcasts, this one really started with a bang, like right out of the gate, like everybody just started sprinting, instead of, you know, that kind of warm up that we normally see. It was just like, bang, off we go, just like a short session. And it's really held its intensity all the way through until now.
Yeah. I feel like there were more, you know, in my subject areas, there were more bills pre-filed before session even started than I think I had seen in those areas for a whole session before. And, you know, focusing on garbage recycling, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like there were a lot of them, and they came out very quickly, and they seemed to move very quickly on hearings and, you know, right out the gate, kind of jumping in on some of these things. So yeah, that feels like it was just, they hit the ground at a full sprint. So.
Well, at day 102 of 105 days, we passed all of our thresholds, all of our cutoffs, so to speak. We've been through, you know, the House of Origin cutoffs. We've been through the opposite House cutoffs. The legislature is working right now. They're doing what's called concurrence. So they're looking at the bills that, you know, started in one chamber and finished in the other chamber and had some changes in the, you know, through the process. And they're trying to come together to say, okay, we accept the changes or we don't. And, you know, if we don't, can we conference and figure that out, et cetera. Bills can still die during that process, but it's much more rare, you know, if it's made it through the full legislature at this point, there's a really good chance that it's going to be signed into law. And since we're, you know, this is kind of the time of year where we don't have a lot to do right now from an urgency standpoint, other than just watching, paying attention to what's going on, and then waiting for budgets. So let's talk about, you know, since it's really just the budget that we're waiting for and most of the policy stuff is done, let's talk about, you know, what you saw this year in policy bills. Where would you like to start?
You know, I think just because it's been where my head has been at the last couple of weeks, I think just starting in some of the solid waste and recycling bills would be, I think, a good place to start. Plus, that's informing a good portion of what interim work I'll be doing with our solid waste folks.
Well, so, we just did a breaking news podcast, what, 2 weeks ago maybe, on a solid waste bill. That was the extended producer responsibility bill, right?
Yeah, which I guess would be old news now, but it was breaking news at the time.
Right.
But yeah, that was that EPR bill is one that's going to take up a lot of our attention and time over the next, definitely over the next interim, but likely over the next.
Just remind us what that bill does again.
It creates a program that requires the producers of packaging and paper products to be responsible for collecting, transporting, processing, and recycling the things that we buy. It'll be sort of use the existing system. Producers will be required to build that out, hopefully increase the amount of things that are recyclable, increase the amount of things that get recycled, and increase the amount of things that are made out of recycled products.
And in theory, they're supposed to pay for that, right? So instead of, you know, people paying for recycling like they do now through curbside, through their monthly bill, et cetera, it's going to be these producers of these packaging products and paper products that actually have the responsibility for the system, for paying for the system, et cetera. Now, of course, we all know what happens to increased costs, you know, associated with manufacturing and product packaging. They end up, you know, being, you know, placed upon the consumer in a different way, usually through the purchase of that product. But it's really just kind of moving the money around. I don't want to go into a ton of detail about that one because there's a whole half hour, 45 minutes that people can listen to if they want to tune in on that one. But anything else to say about that one before we move on to others?
Just that it's going to be a long road to get there. And when I say long road, I guess, you know, it doesn't start until 2030.
And there's a lot of work that
needs to be done. There's needs assessments. There's helping counties understand what their options are and how to participate. It's making sure that all the data is there. So, you know, as we shared in the other podcast, this bill has been, this might be the fourth or fifth year. I can't remember where we landed, but it's going to be another 4 to 5 years of working on it and making sure that everything's in place and a lot of big projects. So, so that's just all I'll add is that there's just a lot of real work that starts now before the program even is rolled out. So,
well, what other solid waste bills did you work on? And what were the outcomes?
On the vein of extended producer responsibility bills, there were a few that were introduced related to some products that are more difficult to handle or recycle. Like there was a bill that came out that would have developed an extended producer responsibility bill for mattresses, which are a big problem. They're bulky. They're difficult to tear apart to get that their materials. They're often what is amongst illegally dumped items, especially in multifamily complexes.
When you talk about a landfill, like you said, they're big and they're bulky. They also don't compact very well because there's usually some kind of spring or something in there.
It's like it's part of their marketing is how springy and non-compacting they are. So yeah,
that's how you get a mattress that's more durable. Some sort of product responsibility or EPR program for mattresses has been discussed for a while. Is this the first time we've seen a bill? Was this the first year we've seen the bill or did we see it previously?
I don't believe I've seen it previously.
I
wouldn't be surprised if there have been efforts. I know that there's been efforts in Washington to address this problem. And I think there's similar legislation in Oregon, but I don't know if it had been introduced here, but this was the first year that I saw it. And it was sort of introduced as a new topic to begin to think about and likely something that will pass in the next interim. It did not make it out of the House where it was introduced.
So. Okay, so this one failed.
Yes.
But you expect to see it again?
I would expect to. I know that was the intent was to introduce it now and really work on it. And this would be a good one because it's something that is difficult for, you know, county solid waste programs to manage. It's really hard for people to get rid of these mattresses. And so having some type of a formal program with some investment or accountability from the producers, again, would be very helpful because right now they're just a huge problem and are just getting landfilled in a lot of places. So,
you know, these EPR bills or these extended producer responsibility bills or product stewardship bills. They seem to, you know, we seem to have a theme, I guess, and maybe that's not the right word, but they definitely seem to be a trend, right? In recent years, we've seen paint. What was that one called?
I would have remembered it as soon as,
what was the name of
paint
the
program? Care.
Yeah. Paint Care.
Paint Care. Wow.
Yeah. That one, you know, was considered for at least 2 or 3 years before it got passed. Mm-hmm. We've had batteries, light bulbs have been in place for a long time, electronics for a long time, but we've also seen, recently, and I guess this isn't really, an EPR program, but these right to repair bills for things like small electronics, like cell phones or computers. A lot of these companies like Apple, right? They like to be, maybe I shouldn't call out a company by name, but a lot of these electronics companies, they like to be really proprietary on, you know, not only who can fix their stuff, but how you actually can get into their stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to have the right tool that might be specialized. You have to ask, you know, specialized training and be certified, that sort of thing. There have been a lot of bills that have been trying to make it easier for, you know, just regular repair shops to get that certification, or even for consumers to be able to get a hold of the tools or equipment that they need to repair the stuff themselves. And we've seen those bills for a couple of years. Did any progress get made on those this year?
Yes. This year's version of the right to repair bill, which would require parts to be available for businesses that repair phones and plans and schematics, did pass.
Oh, it did.
Yeah, that did pass this year. The number escapes me off the top of my head, but that bill passed. But that that one is definitely something that had come up the 3 years in all three of my sessions, that's been a topic. Yeah. A lot of the challenges were around, you know, these companies make money because their products are unique and their products are theirs. And so just to be able to protect both, you know, to be able to protect people's personal data on the phone, to be able to protect that business's right to their unique products. But really the ultimate goal is just to, you know, extend the life of these products, or even if I break my phone and I just don't want to go through the process of repairing it, that somebody could repair that phone and that could go to a program that provides phones to other people as well.
Sure, right? it could be reused. Yeah,
right. So there's quite a few benefits there, but I think, you know, the primary one being fewer turnover in electronic devices is a benefit for multiple reasons. So,
are there any other EPR type programs or product stewardship programs that have been considered or that passed this year?
No others that passed. There was another one that was considered around clothing and textiles. So the fast fashion industry, there's a pretty growing issue in the amount of clothing that is produced around the world and is intended to be used a couple of times. And then discarded. The ability for...
What type of clothing is that?
I don't want to use brand names, but wherever you would go for, I don't want to say this rudely, like cheap clothing. Like I'm thinking like pretty much anything you would buy on Amazon, anything you would buy on Temu, anything you would buy on like, I mean, like it covers everything. Like I can go on Amazon and buy like 10 Calvin Klein white button-up dress shirts for $20.
Wow.
They're not going to last.
Yeah.
I don't really know what's in them. And they're not going to survive me donating and... you know, moving, okay. They're going to fall apart pretty quickly. So it'd just be like cheap clothing that is not intended for long-term use. It's more about making something that's cheap and accessible to people who want something and can't get the more expensive version.
That's interesting, because when I saw this bill, I thought, why do we need, you know, why do we need some sort of EPR program for textiles? We have all kinds of things like clothing banks and secondhand stores and vintage shops and consignment shops, right, where people can take those items and places to just donate as well, right, where they could take those items and they can find a new home and get mm-hmm. reused. I mean, clothing is always the biggest item at a garage sale, for, you know, for instance. And mm-hmm. and sometimes that vintage wear that, you know, I was wearing in high school, you know, becomes the coolest, hottest thing for teenagers. And it's more, you know, in some cases, it's worth more than I even paid for it, you know, back in the 1990s or late 80s here. See, now I'm, you know, people.
You're dating yourself.
Yeah, they can do the math.
You also said you were 50 little bit ago.
Easy.
So. Oh, sorry.
Easy. That was before we started the podcast.
Oh,
and
no.
Now you've...
Oh, no. I can say how old I am if that helps. I don't think people...
It doesn't.
No,
because there's too much of a gap between you and me. It's just going to make me feel worse. Let's move on. You have successfully derailed the podcast. We need to get back to where we were.
So your clothes, you know, I think about this too in my own life where it's very easy to, you know, I don't want to get too crazy here, but like just consumer culture and the idea of just always wanting something new and how quickly something you have is no longer cool. Even if it was Paul's cool clothes from the 80s, like there's always something new. And I always think back to like,
thank you for saying that, Paul's cool clothes from the 80s. I like it.
Even just this concept of, and I don't expect this to go into the podcast, but even just this concept of like,
oh, it's going,
there are fewer closets in houses that are older than there are today. And it's because like, we didn't have as many outfits. Like we had, you know,
yeah,
like,
that's true.
Right.
That's true.
I mean, I don't know how many suits you got, like a suit for every day for 2 weeks or something like that. I don't know if that's true or not, but like
at this point it is. Yeah.
But like, people just had three professional outfits.
Right.
They smelled awful, but they just wore those three outfits.
Well, again, you had one pair of dress shoes if you were lucky, right? One pair of regular shoes and then a pair of, you know, maybe work shoes, like work boots or something like that. When I was a kid, I had one pair of shoes. Just one. That's it.
Just one shoe or one pair of shoes?
No. Thankfully, we had both sides, a left and a right, but we certainly didn't have multiple pairs.
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, that's not a thing. Yeah, I didn't have, you know, I've got four pairs of dress shoes in my office. That's not something that used to happen. And it's ridiculous. I will say it's ridiculous. But I think I'd learned that too when we were house shopping and like these newer houses have like massive amounts of closets because we own so many more pieces of clothing now. But also like the fashion changes so quickly or the desire to, you know, have new styles and new clothes that are cool and the old ones go. I was talking to there's a nonprofit that I was talking to a couple of weeks ago to kind of understand a little bit more about this clothing. And they're housed in Ghana, which was, I've never talked to somebody in Ghana before. Uh-huh. So that was very cool.
South America?
It's in Africa.
I knew that. I was just messing
It's where U2's from. U2's from Ghana. Okay. had me for a second. I was wait a second. I've been thinking it was in Africa this whole time. I'm more certain about Werewolves being in Twilight than I am that Ghana is. No, it's in Africa.
Yeah. No, I was just ripping off of that joke on our last podcast. It was. you gave me a good look on that one.
you had me for a second. I was like, oh no. You know, they shared that Ghana has one of the world's largest secondhand clothing, where a lot of the clothing that gets donated here in the U.S., what they shared with me, and I haven't vetted these facts, but what they shared with me was that, you know, 10% of the clothing that gets donated to your local donation location gets put out on the shelves. Everything else gets sent to waste or, you know, repurposing. And so...
So if you're sending something to a clothing... to some sort of...
if I'm dropping them off at the place down the street where I'm also dropping off my picture frames
shop
and
or
my,
whatever, they're sorting through that.
Yes.
And they're only keeping 10% of the best stuff?
That's what they told me. That's what I was told. That the amount of clothing that's going into this facility, 10% is getting put back out. The rest of it goes someplace.
Gets jumped somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes what I've been learning is that it's baled and then it's sent to the secondhand markets where, you know, they employ people to transport the bales, take what clothing they can, reassemble them into new clothing. But they process these clothing and it's this massive facility in Ghana where, you know, all of these clothes are shipped and people are responsible at sifting through all of those things.
How do they process it? Do they break down the fabrics and the fibers and make new fabrics and fibers, or do they just reuse the good portions of, are they literally cutting around the bad stuff and then somehow piecing things together?
I think it's both. Like I said, I'm talking to these folks to help gather more information and potentially put these in front of our solid waste managers in the coming year to help us understand, like, why do we need clothing EPR and what's the impact of having it versus not having it? And what's the deal with clothing EPR? Like, you know, kind of figuring that out. But, but what they showed me were some photographs in their slides around, like, sometimes it is like they are able to find similar fabrics and patch or repair clothing that's damaged, or literally cutting things up using the good portions of fabric to create new outfits or new pieces of clothing. But
I had no idea that was going on.
They're carrying these 50-pound bales of clothing around on their heads.
Yeah.
And they're walking, you know, from home to these factories and these places where they're, so it's just this massive, and even they're not saving 100% of the clothing. There's still a significant amount of waste that goes into that. So
is that what this clothing and textiles bill would have done, is somehow created more of that, or did it change it to a different model?
I think similar to our recycling crisis that we had in the National Sword campaign.
Yeah, that was in 2018, 2019, 2020.
Yeah. So I think just like that, the recycling crisis we had when countries overseas were telling us we're no longer taking your recyclables because...
That was mostly a contamination issue, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that what's happening here is that we're sending these products elsewhere. They're taking care of what they can, and then they're now responsible for disposal. And they're dealing with the litter, and they're dealing with the impacts of having to process all that clothing. So I think the idea is to be able to, it's an important function to have, to take and repair clothing.
Yeah.
But I think the bill would require producers of clothing, especially fast fashion, to create programs to get the clothing that's disposed of that they make to facilities like this, or maybe ones that are more socially and environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. And ultimately make sure that, you know, that clothing that can't be repaired isn't landfilled or littered or, you know, et cetera. So
one of the real attractions to that type of clothing, as you mentioned, though, is the price. Mm-hmm. So this is going to change that.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you would assume so. I don't know, you know, to what extent durable clothing would get more expensive. I don't know how they would play into these programs. You know, that was one of the things too. Like my grandparents were proud of the fact that they had like a 50-year-old hat from, you know, a local Pacific Northwest brand that made stuff out of wool and lasted a long time. Or my father-in-law has jackets that he's had since he was, you know, a teenager. And it's a point of pride to have things that last a long time.
That local Pacific Northwest brand, where was it actually made?
Seattle.
Starts with an F, maybe?
Starts with an F, rhymes with Wilson.
Oh.
The volleyball from, yeah.
Yeah, Castaway.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a Tom Hanks reference.
Exactly.
Nicely done. Thank you. Where was that island, do you know?
Wasn't in Ghana.
No, it wasn't. Like, see how I'm bringing everything back to that whole, yeah.
Pretty sure he was trapped on Ireland, I thought, right? That was the island? Trapped in Ireland.
And Bono was there. That's how... God, but it was near Australia. That's how that whole thing, see how it comes full circle.
I don't understand why you said Australia. Is that where the island was for real, or are you just...
I just made that up.
Oh, okay. I mean, it sounds believable.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah.
I know it was in the ocean. I don't know where.
It was. That's where islands tend to be.
Most of them.
Yeah, most of them are in the ocean.
I mean, you could have just been off the coast of Florida in that movie for all I know.
It could have been, yeah. But
okay, but anyways.
We wanted to bring, I had to bring that whole thing full circle, especially since we're talking about the circular economy, right? So, well,
and that's a good point too, is that this is not just a U.S. thing. This is global.
It's global. Right?
I mean, worldwide. Just like everything we're talking about, it's not just the U.S.
Well, because most of the manufacturers of clothing that's sold in the U.S. aren't in the U.S., right? Yeah. Especially this fast fashion that you're talking about. So, mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah. Yeah, we can go on. I could go on and on. But yeah, so that's something we're going to learn a lot more about. Hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about the overall problem that the bill is trying to address. And then hopefully later in the year, we'll be able to connect with the legislators that sponsored both a bill on clothing EPR, or extended producer responsibility, but also on some of the reporting on some of the toxins that are in the clothes that they're using. So, you know, PFAS have been a very big topic in the last 5 years at least. And
related to all kinds of products, but it's definitely in clothing as well.
Right. It's amazing how many items of clothing I have in my closet that I wouldn't even think are primarily plastic in some form or another.
Yeah. Why would you think about it?
Right. I don't want to think about it now, but, but yeah, I mean, all of the things that we love, yeah, everything has PFAS. Anyway, so yeah, so we're going to spend some more time understanding that. And I think that's one too, where a lot of our county solid waste programs will do clothing swaps. They'll try their best to, you know, help folks, you know, learn how to repurpose or how to prepare things for donation. Or there's a lot of sites online or other places where, you know, you can sell clothing rather than just donate them if you have the time and effort. So I think just, you know, it's a significant waste product. It's something that everybody uses.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is do we have any good statistics on how much of this product actually ends up in our landfills?
We have statewide waste characterization data that
Is textiles a big piece of it?
I don't know. I couldn't say the portion. It used to be something we would lump into organics.
Right.
Because it was organic.
Yeah.
Now it's not.
It was so cotton, right?
I would need to go back and check. But it's enough for them to pull out a full separate category. And it could be a small portion, but at the same time, just like with some of the other things, food, other things we've talked about, there's people out there that can use these things and need these things. If there's a step that clothing can take before it goes to the landfill, then that's better. So.
Well, Travis, these EPR bills, like I said, seem to be a trend. I think we're probably going to see a lot more of them as we look forward towards future sessions. I know that there's, you know, some appliance EPRs that are out there that people are thinking about, right? And I'm sure that there are others. But were there other categories of solid waste bills? I think there's at least one more kind of big one that passed pretty recently, right? 1154.
Yeah.
Jamie was in here, I think yesterday or the day before when we got a podcast with her on kind of the public health wrap up. She was mentioning that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a big one. And that was one that, you know, right before session, we started working on it and we had, worked on it all the way as long as we could, right? At the last minute, we were still making tweaks. And Jamie and I worked very closely together, talked to a lot of our members. This bill will give local health jurisdictions tools in the form of penalties and fines that will help them in proper management of solid waste facilities. So their transfer stations, composting facilities, active landfills, closed landfills, et cetera.
Does it apply to public facilities as well as privately owned and operated facilities?
The bill applies to all solid waste handling facilities. Okay. So private,
whether it's owned by a city or a county or ABC, you know, waste company, these tools would apply.
Yes.
Okay.
And so we'll be spending some time really helping our counties, especially those that operate and own facilities, sort of how to navigate that bill and what this could look like. But we work quite a bit on that one, and it did pass and it did go through concurrence. And that one was, it was a frustrating one.
Yeah.
That one was, I don't know what Jamie talked about, so I don't want to be,
She just mentioned that, but, you know, while it was frustrating and while, you know, we weren't happy with the passage of the bill, that we did make some progress in making it better.
Yeah. Yeah. We made some progress. And I think that's largely in part to the fact that our members stood up and, chose to engage and put themselves out there or took time to provide us with the information that we needed. So that one that was really an all hands on deck kind of a bill. And I don't think we would have made the changes that we made without that, both, you know, public health solid waste cooperation, but also our members at staff and elected levels really helping us out. So that was a big win as far as collaboration goes. So,
well, a good example of how, you know, we really oftentimes have to, there's a lot of teamwork that goes on behind the scenes here at WASAC and in the legislature that involves not just our policy team members, but also our WASAC members, county commissioners, council members, counselors, elected county executives, and members of the legislature, you know, to get these things done or to get these things fixed, so to speak. Well, solid waste isn't the only issue that you work in for us. You also were overseeing environmental concerns and issues for the counties this year. Clean energy kind of fits in that environmental piece, but we call it out because it's such a big issue for our members. And then also wildland fire management. Any, you know, were you working any legislation in any of those categories that you want to mention?
Yeah, there were a couple, and some of them overlapped with some of the land use stuff. So this was sort of, you know, Curtis and I, or you and Curtis and I, kind of navigating some of these areas. Yeah. But I will say overall, it sort of felt like around the wildfire front and around the forest health front, it was quieter this year than I had seen in recent years working with you on these bills. There were a few that applied to state agencies or funding. Like FireWise, making sure that there's funding for the fire prevention and the fire recovery programs that DNR has.
And of course, we haven't seen the budgets yet.
Yeah,
even so though we're a couple of days out, they still haven't released the final versions of the budget, so we don't know, you know, how those funding proposals came out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But it felt light, and I don't know, you know, I asked around to try and understand. I don't know if it's because there's a new commissioner of public lands there and they're, you know, trying to you know, sort of settle in before.
Well, there was definitely a transition going on. Yeah.
But it also felt like what you just said is there was a lot of focus on retaining the funding for the programs that had passed in recent years.
Yeah.
So there was not a lot on the wildfire and forestry and forest health front. But I don't know what that'll look like next year. For sure. That's a mystery. As far as climate goes, there were a few. Well, I guess the other one I would say on the wildfire front was there was a bill that would have required the full scope of the wildland urban interface building code to be implemented once the risk assessments were done.
Right.
That bill did not pass. But that was one where I think, you know, because it was land use and because it was wildfire, I think we ended up shifting that to land use. And so I think, I don't know if Curtis or Kelsey worked on that one, but watched it, but that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, several of us worked on that one. I know you did. I'm pretty sure Curtis and Kelsey and myself all worked on that one. And that was a trailer bill to one that we had seen in the past that had been amended after a couple of years to require the DNR to create these new maps around wildfire hazard and risk management from a wildland fire perspective outside, well, not really outside of just countywide and statewide, and then implement some new requirements under the Wildland Urban Interface Code. And then it was, I think the bill was actually by request of the State Building Code Council to even go further than that. But you know, the maps aren't done yet. Some of the other implementation from previous bills hadn't even occurred yet. So I think it was a good thing that that one got set aside, at least for now.
Yeah. Moving on, I think, you know, there wasn't also a ton of new policy related to climate. If there was, you know, one, for example, like one I was watching gave counties an option to require that if you sell your house, you have to do an environmental analysis of the house to tell the, you know. So that one, again, we didn't engage. We watched. It didn't move. But it felt more like this year. And again, this is my potentially still, you know, rookie interpretation, but it felt more like this year climate-wise was protecting protecting and implementing and funding the policies and programs that had built in previous sessions. So
which there were a lot,
right? So where does, yeah, you know, how does the Healthy Environment for All, the HEAL Act, you know, how is that going to play out? How is environmental justice going to look in you know, growth management planning, and how are all these other, you know, the Climate Commitment Act funds, how are they going to be used? So it seemed like there was a lot more refining,
yeah,
and protecting.
There was that other bill, if you remember, around incorporating environmental justice into the State Environmental Policy Act. And I think that's the second or third version of that that we've seen. And I know you worked on that. I worked on that. I think Kelsey worked on that a little bit too. So another team effort, but that ended up not going anywhere either.
Yeah. But I am also on a participating on behalf of WASAC on the environmental justice for hydrogen, citing hydrogen any. So just there's some projects that are rolling out related, yeah, to that. But it felt, yeah, more like it was a focus on let's get these programs protected or moving along and not pass a lot of new policy. It was largely, I don't want to say boring, because there was still plenty to do and still a lot of waiting and figuring out exactly how things that did come up impacted counties, but from a county perspective, it was a pretty uneventful climate legislation session.
But you did work on a pretty big bill around clean energy, right?
Yeah. You and I worked quite a bit on House Bill 1960, which was the bill that Representative Rammel introduced as a result of the clean energy property tax impacts projects we did over the interim and the research that we had done over the last couple of years, so that this bill would have addressed the property tax shift issue that we had learned about and that counties were experiencing. And our members, our partner affiliates, you know, assessors, treasurers, worked really hard on this bill over the interim and worked really hard on it during session. And it had some movement, but ultimately didn't make it out of the House of Origin.
Yeah, it was an interesting bill. You know, I was glad to see it introduced this year.
I mean, that just alone was exciting to have a project immediately yield a bill was a very cool thing to experience.
Yeah, I mean, it really was driven in large part, I think probably 98% by the work that you and I did over, and mostly you did, with the facilitation of the task force over the interim. And it wasn't just our members that were on that task force, right? We brought in all kinds of people that we thought would be interesting stakeholders, brought them to the table, including developers and state agencies and
legislators, nonprofits, other states.
Yeah. Right?
We had other, right. like New York participants, like they just wanted to see what we were doing and wanted to help us. So yeah, right. it was a big, big effort. That email contact list is pretty long at this point. So,
you know, when you're trying to deal with a complex effort that requires new legislation, the playbook is you don't do it alone, right? You bring in a bunch of other people, you develop allies, you even bring in the folks that you think are going to oppose it because you want to know that early, right? And you want to see if you can work it out with them, et cetera. We did all that work, right? We put together a really, and again, you did most of the research for it, and then you and I collaborated on it, a report or a study that laid out the problem pretty clearly, you know, mm-hmm. very complex problem in pretty understandable terms with really good data. And then we put together the task force to try to find solutions and help them understand the problem. And then that resulted in a bill being introduced. And even after all that work, 2 years essentially of work, the bill turned out to be really controversial, mm-hmm. even amongst some of the stakeholders who were part of the process. Did that surprise you?
I mean, it absolutely surprised me. I was thinking about this the other day in the sense of like, I think that bill gave me most of the experiences people get when working on bills. I was thinking about like, you know how like, well, you know, you're a big mountain climbers, right? It makes sense. Like if you're going to climb on Annapurna, you're right. You're big on mountain climbing. So this this analogy is going to make a lot of sense.
But I like, hike a lot, but I don't know about mountain climbing.
You know how like if somebody's going to be climbing like Annapurna or Everest or one of the big mountains, they train on Rainier.
Because I'm going to take your word
for
it.
Did you know this?
Yeah, no.
Ed Beast, okay.
There's no. I'm going to take your word for it.
We're going to probably cut this out, but it fascinates me because Mount Rainier has almost every feature that you run into if you're going to be climbing all of the tallest mountains in the world.
Oh, really? I didn't know
that.
So
like,
you mean like ice and rocks?
Right. Yeah. All the hazards. It's basically up elevation. You know, it goes up like most mountains
steep
do.
Steep stuff.
Yeah. But like surprise storms. Like people train on Mount Rainier because it gives them the full gamut of experiences in a more controlled environment in Washington versus.
That's
a fun fact you can say.
Okay.
There's a guy named Ed Viesters, climbs all the crazy mountains, is from Seattle and just trained everywhere on Rainier.
Well, that's good to know.
So anyways, I think this bill gave me just about every experience
for
that
you aspiring
need.
Mountain climbers out there. That's a hot tip, pro tip.
Yeah. Whether it's legislation or climbing mountains, this bill was my Mount Rainier, like a training bill.
Beautiful.
So, you know, I think this bill gave me a lot of the experiences that I hadn't had working on legislation yet. It had everything.
Yeah.
Like it had like, I don't want to say backstabbing, but it had like, it had controversy. It had us running around trying to sell this bill, begging and pleading with people to support.
We were trying to keep it alive mm-hmm. so that we could keep working on it. I mean, this one, if you want to learn how to lobby a bill from start to finish, really from kind of inception of, you know, of what is the problem and idea and how do you get through, you definitely got a good taste of that. We didn't get it finished. Didn't get over the finish line, but I'm confident we will at some point in the future.
But I think some of the biggest surprises were people that I thought would vehemently support the bill came out fighting.
Yeah.
Like, came out swinging. And even in our, you know, myself included, like there were times when it was like, this bill is moving, but there's still parts of it we don't like. So that idea of like, working with you to like, when exactly do we pull the plug? Or when, you know, when is it okay to feel comfortable about this moving versus not moving? So this idea of like, we kept it alive so that we could keep working on it and keep shaping it and keep fixing it, even if it wasn't exactly what we wanted. And I think that uncertainty, especially with a big problem and a big change like this, is it gets really scary. And I think it feels much safer to be like, let's just abandon ship now.
Yeah.
Because it's not going in the direction, versus let's stick with it and help it go in the right direction.
Yeah, let's steer the ship a little bit. Let's move it in the right direction.
Yeah, but it felt
lot harder to do, right?
It's really hard.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying because you don't know if you're working on something that is going to be what you expected it to be when you started.
Because at the end of the day,
doing it on behalf of your members.
Yeah, so. At the end of the day, we're not in control, right? We identified the problem. We helped identify the solutions, and now you know we help write a bill. But it's not our name on that bill. Mm-hmm. And guess what? You and I don't get to vote on it either. Mm-hmm. So once you write that bill and you release it into the world, so to speak, you know there's all kinds of things that can happen to that bill. It could get hijacked by the other party. It could get hijacked by another representative or a senator. You know, someone can throw a bunch of amendments on it that, you know, completely change how the bill works or who is affected by the bill or how they're affected, right? So it's a very slow process that really takes a lot of time and effort. And you have to know what you're talking about. And when you're talking about, you know, property tax bills and complex issues around, you know, how certain projects are taxed and how they might affect residents and, you know, other junior taxing districts like schools and fire districts and others, it can get pretty complex pretty fast.
Well,
and
I think
there's a lot of people that have an interest in it.
Yeah. No, there was a lot of people that had an interest, including, I remember at least two or three times thinking, why does this group care?
Right.
Like, I can't even, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon to them and this bill. Like, I don't, like, how and why do you care?
Right. And then you've got to make that phone call and say, okay, enlighten me. What mm-hmm. am I not understanding here? And,
yeah.
And, oh, I had no idea that was part of this issue.
That's the other piece that would pop up. How many times did we just figured this thing out yesterday that, I mean, we'd been working on this for like 2 years. And then we learned that, you know, there's some, you know, other type of property tax out there that nobody caught. And now we've got to scramble to fix that.
Right.
It was, you know, we talk about building the plane while you're flying it as a bad thing, but I'm also, you know, in a lot of cases, but I think that's sort of what we were doing, but I don't think there's a different way to do it. I think that's just how it gets done. And I don't know if that's the right connection, but it was just sort of like, as long as the plane's not in the air, nobody's going to care about it. So you got to keep it in there.
Well,
you're making all these bad metaphors.
Yeah, but
probably going to crash into Rainier where they're training for climbing. And I don't know anymore. So
pro tip, don't crash your plane into Rainier. But I mean, you talked about the fact that it kind of goes back to, you know, if we go back to the earlier part of our conversation here on this podcast, we talked about the EPR bill. We talked about it, you know, at the last podcast too. This was the fifth year for the EPR bill, right? Mm-hmm. 5 years. And at some point, somebody just has to put, you do your research, you bring your people together, as many as you can, as many as you can think of, and you just put something out there. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah. During the session, you're flying whatever you put out there and you're making adjustments, you know, in flight, trying to keep it going and trying to keep it being worked on, you know, keep the interest in up on it, keep the momentum up on it so that it just doesn't die somewhere and no one cares about it anymore. But that is the process. And, you know, you land that plane for the session, sometimes, you know, at the finish line and sometimes well short of it. We ended mm-hmm. up well short this year.
Yeah.
Right. The bill stayed alive, passed cutoff. But we never really found kind of that sweet spot that we could say, okay, we've got enough people in agreement here that we think we can take the next step or the next step or the next step. Representative Rammel was a great partner. I expect we'll be working on this again during the interim. I expect this is going to be probably a big part of your interim work to try to, you know, refine it and come back next year with another, you know, version that hopefully can gain a lot more support than we found this year.
Yeah. Because, you know, we get to pick up, hopefully, the plane wherever we left it. Hopefully we get to pick it up as is, dust it off and start from there.
Yeah.
So we don't have to start from scratch. But, you know, but again, similar to the bill that I talked about earlier, I think this was also a very good example of, you know, you mentioned we invited a lot of stakeholders, but I would think between our members, between the assessors and the treasurers, there was a significant amount of energy that was put into this.
Yeah.
That is not part of their traditional LSC duties or part of their regular association duties. Like, this was a project that they were interested in and they walked the hill. They knocked on doors with us, they advocated for us, and they went through the whole interim process with us. And I think that is a huge piece of mostly the reason that it had success was because this solution came from a place of people that are out there doing this work and experiencing what is happening, and their voice was important. So I think that's a huge learning opportunity as well, to really empower our members to engage in these processes, because their voices are important. So
yeah, well, a lot more to come on that one.
Yeah,
you know, Travis, I always, you know, that question I asked you at the beginning of, you know, how do you compare this session to previous sessions? I always find that every session's unique. You know what I mean? It's hard to compare them. When you stack up a bunch of sessions kind of in your work history, it's a little easier to say, yeah, okay, that felt more like, you know, a normal or an abnormal or whatever. But every session is unique. There's always unique topics to talk about. There's a lot of carryover topics as well, but there's always, you know, something eventful, I think, that happens every single time. And you know, what I love the most about the session is the start. And then the second thing I love most about the session is the end, you know, because you really do get this kind of start and finish, and then a period of opportunity to work on really great projects like the bill we were just talking about. And then you get to go try it again and see if it works.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the great things about what we do here at WASAC on the policy team.
I've been joking. I think I joked with you a couple of times and others around like this. You know, the badges that Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts get when they reach certain milestones or have certain experiences.
Call us and, merit badges.
And, yeah, merit badges. And yeah. I feel like our work in doing session as lobbyists and advocates for counties, I feel like there were definitely some badges, merit badges that I got this year that I hadn't before. I won't go through all of them, but like
I feel like making little badges for you now.
Well, I think, but I think we should all wear
get
them
a sash.
And a sash.
I think they call
but I think that
sash.
Should be all of us. I don't want to be the only one. I think all of us need to celebrate the experiences we've had that have informed us. But like, you know, this was,
I think everyone badges. Will get behind the celebration, but I think you might be the only one wearing a merit badge.
What do I feel like people are going to start showing up with patches and badges that they think are funny that I'm going to have to wear next?
They might keep my mouth shut.
All right.
Well, Travis, good work this session.
Thanks.
I'm glad you made it through. I know it was pretty intense. It was a difficult session. I think most people would agree with that. It was a very long session for a long session too, it felt like.
Yeah. But I think, you know, you and I talked about this yesterday. I think the important thing to note is that we're all still having fun with each other, and you guys are planning to get together to go like clamming. So you guys are voluntarily seeing each other next week after spending four intense months together. And I think that's important to highlight that we're all still in a good place.
Yeah, it's a good team. A lot of good team work here. A lot of good personalities. A lot of good professionals who know how to, you know, work together. And yeah, we battle it out and we fight it out. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm grateful that after session, we all just, you know, don't pack up our stuff and not talk to each other for 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's not a family Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, we're done. We're done with you. Don't talk to me for 6 more weeks,
I'll
right?
see you at the 4th of July.
Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that's not the relationship we have. So we're really lucky, frankly, and really fortunate here at WASAC. And
looking forward to getting more merit badges next session.
Yeah, let's all look forward to that. So, take care until then.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to County Connection. Stay in the loop by subscribing to us through your preferred podcasting app and following us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. And don't forget to join the Hub, your go-to source for the latest news and updates from the Washington State Association of Counties. Until next time, stay connected and stay informed.